All right. Everything's recording. Everything looks good. All right. Dan Greck, thank you for being on Radiant Creators. And the website to check out while we're talking with Dan is The Road Shows Me, which I think is an amazing name for, well, a podcast and an overlanding adventure. We'll definitely get into the origin of that name. But you know, I could read your bio, but you know, like to describe Dan Greck, basically we're looking at somebody who is an overlander, adventurer, author, photographer, videographer. In 7 years, he's done 56 countries, and I think it's more, is it 145,000 miles overlanding?
It would definitely be more than that by now.
Be that right? More than that, yeah.
Yeah, I need to update those stats a little bit.
Yeah, because that's before Iceland, right? I think.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and adventure waits for nobody, and definitely The Road Shows Me is a great place to, theroadshowsme.com is a great place to learn about, more about Greg. I'm sorry, Greg, duh. I mean, Dan Greck. So how are you doing, and how else would you describe yourself? And yeah, I mean, your bio is really good, but what's missing there? Because you've done a bit more since that bio was written.
Yeah, that's right, Craig. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I mean, these days I also have a little baby daughter. So now I'm a family man as well. And just a person who's really passionate about helping other people get out there and kind of live their dream and find a way to make it happen. Whatever it is, you know, not everyone wants to live out of a car and drive around the world. I get that. But I think a lot of people would be excited to be able to have 6 or 12 months to, you know, maybe go up to Alaska or learn guitar or like learn another language or like whatever it is that they're passionate about. And I feel like I've learned a few tricks along the way that people maybe don't know about, or it never really occurred to them that like you don't just have to go to work every day if you're kind of passionate and motivated.
Yeah. And one of the things that I saw on it was, you know, I forget where I saw it, and you put out so much material. But the YouTube channel, The Road Shows Me, is amazing. And you definitely, for anybody who's, overlanding or is a 4x4 enthusiast, which are two different things, we'll get into that. But endless info and nice segments that you've put out about specific topics. And I forget where I saw this, if it was in your book or if it was the beginning of one of your videos, but it was from Otto Leopold, a great line. To those devoid of imagination, a blank space on a map is a useless waste. To others, the most valuable part. And it seems like part of your kind of mission is to help people realize that value once again.
Yeah, definitely, Craig. I feel like part of what I'm doing is to try and get away from kind of, you know, Wi-Fi and busyness and always being online and always being contactable and just going back to the basics. You know, let's just go and camp down by a river and maybe do some fishing or maybe just read a book by the fire. Just, and that's it. Like nothing else. I don't kind of aspire to have like more stuff or more money. I aspire to just live the simple life.
Yeah. And one of the things that you mentioned in one of your videos was, I think it was about gear. You do many videos where you kind of break down gear, what's important and what's not, and maybe things people haven't thought about who haven't done quite as much overlanding as you have. You mentioned that the going is the most important gear. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but sure, there's expensive vehicles, there's different tires, there's you name it. There's, you know, rock sliders, there's all that, you know, but the most important thing, even more important than what kind of winch you have, is the going. And it seems like you've really embraced that passion of the going. And would you say that that's kind of one of your guiding forces is doing life before it's over?
Absolutely, Craig. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that has been like very foundational to things that I'm doing. And oftentimes, like, I really am limited by budget. You know, I don't have unlimited money. And so for me, it just came down to, you know, I could spend all that money on a fancy vehicle and a winch and all of those things, but then I'd have no money left over to actually have the adventure. So somewhere along the line, I just realized prioritize taking the trip, and all of that other stuff is really optional and isn't actually needed. And so that is like my whole priority value system is like going and spending time out there is more important than anything that you can buy.
Yeah. Because you actually mentioned in one of your videos that what, you know, was more important to you, what was more exciting was the trip was, yeah, like I mentioned, the, and you mentioned the going, you know, like the type of vehicle and the gear, that's all neat, but it's not really that exciting. That's just kind of a side thing, you know, and we do live in a culture where, you know, I do look at the, believe me, I love the sprinters, the Mercedes, you know, 4x4 sprinters. I mean, it's wonderful. I don't know how much they'd really hold up. You know, I'm not sure. I've never seen them out in the wild. You know, I've seen them on pavement. I've never really, in going down a dirt road, but I'm not sure how they would, I don't know if they'd really overland so well. They seem kind of fragile.
No, I think they hold up really well. Actually.
They do. Okay.
Yeah, they're really, really common now. People drive the entire Pan American Highway with them, you know, from Alaska to Argentina.
Really?
And yeah. I think they're really good vehicles.
Wow, that's amazing. And then, so the thing is with those, you know, like your price point, even for a used one, is extraordinary. Or for some, it's probably nothing. But for most people, that's a pretty pricey vehicle. But there is the joy of doing it in a Volkswagen bus as well.
That's right. Yeah. And it really is, it's kind of like everything in life. There's a whole range of choices you can make. Do you want to have more creature comforts when you're in camp? You know, do you want to be inside and warm and dry and you can spend more money and have a bigger vehicle? Or are you really happy to rough it and just sleep in a ground tent and just take, you know, like an old Subaru is a perfect vehicle.
Yeah.
It'll take you basically anywhere on the planet. And then you have to work so much less to actually buy the thing. And then, so the adventure comes around that much sooner.
Yeah. I like that. Like, you know, get on with the adventure. It's there's great philosopher said, like there's boldness in the doing, you know, that when you it's amazing how the universe just kind of lays out that red carpet. Once you take the first couple steps, you know, the adventure will sort of come and grab you, you know? Yeah. And here's one I thought I'd throw out there for fun is, you know, in the Jeep culture, cause you've done most of your traveling, I think all of it, all of your overlanding in Jeeps, you know, well, we all know the duck thing, you know, somebody gave somebody a little ducky and now we give each other ducks in the Jeep community and people have ducks across their dashboards. It's cute. But you know, through your adventures, I think you may have found that maybe a toy snake would be a better thing for Jeep culture to trade back and forth. I mean, that might be really maybe more useful if you got a dashboard full of snakes. can you tell people your snake story?
Yeah, for sure. It actually started when I was planning my trip around Africa and kind of trying to think of safety and all. Mm-hmm. There were so many things to think about. And I read somewhere, someone once said, put a toy snake on your dashboard. And I didn't know if they were serious or not. And then when I was in Morocco, right at the start of the trip, I saw in a street market, someone was selling kind of a wooden carved snake. And so I bought it and I put it on my dashboard. And it actually turned out to be one of the most important safety things I ever had with me. Because amazingly, and it makes sense, a lot of people across Africa are really afraid of snakes because there are a lot of deadly ones. And if you're out working in the fields or you live in a mud hut, probably you've had a run-in with a deadly snake. And sadly, you probably even know someone that's been killed by a deadly snake. So the vast majority of people, when they see the snake on the dashboard, they literally take three steps backwards. And I had people refuse to put gas in the Jeep. I had military guys carrying AK-47s who would like step away from me and like wave me through their checkpoint. Once they saw the snake, they just didn't want anything to do with me or the vehicle, which, you know, turned out better than any car alarm or any kind of, you know, safety feature.
Mm. I like that. Yeah. So, you know, so maybe rather than the rubber duckies, if you're in the Jeep community, we could switch to little snakes. That'd be kind of fun. Have a Jeep full of snakes. Well, you know, when you first took your trip, so I think your first big trip was the the Pan American Highway. And that's something. So you're working at a ski lodge, you saved your money up, you know, you bought an inexpensive Jeep, and you just went for it. And that was probably your most like primal vehicle, you know, the least modified. And that trip, when you took that trip, well, first, could you define like what that trip was? Because you know the stats, just like the high level of what you did, because not everyone knows what the Pan American, you know, highway is. And then also, what was overlanding at that time? Because you're kind of like the Les Stroud of overlanding, I like to call it, because, you know, he was doing survival videos before anybody else was, you know. And I think you really went and began to document your overlanding trip. I think you're really, as far as I know, one of the first people to do it, I think. I mean, others have done it, but, you know, what was overlanding even like? Was there even the word overlanding when you took your first trip?
Yeah, Craig. No, I had never even heard the word before. I read a couple of books of really well-known people who had ridden motorbikes around the world, like Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman. Ewan McGregor from Star Wars. Basically, him and his best mate have done quite a few big motorbike trips around the world. And then one way back in the day, in the 60s, a guy called Ted Simon rode a motorbike literally around the whole world. And his book is called Jupiter's Travels. And it is the most inspirational, amazing book I've ever read in my life. Because the part that really stood out to me is that Ted was just an ordinary guy. He had no sponsors. He had no special training. He wasn't rich. He did the whole thing on a shoestring budget as just a normal person. You know, he doesn't have multiple passports or diplomatic anything. He doesn't work for National Geographic. And so when I put that book down, I looked in the mirror and I said, like, I think I could do that. If he can, why can't I?
Yeah.
And I was actually working a desk job at the time in Calgary in Canada, and I wasn't enjoying it. And it wasn't what I wanted to do with my life. And so I had this little two-door Jeep, the little TJ, and I'd always wanted to go to Alaska. So I said, that's it. I'm going to throw my camping gear in the Jeep, and I'm going to drive up to the top of Alaska. And so I did that. I went all the way up to the Arctic Ocean and had an incredible summer exploring Alaska. Absolutely loved it. And then as I was moving south, a friend suggested that I should go to Mexico, you know, spend some time on the beach, get some waves. And then when I bought a map of Mexico, it included all of Central America. And then inevitably, I bought a map of South America. And I did a little bit of research online, and I did find a couple of blogs of people who had done it. So I knew in theory it was possible. And so I said, yeah, let's go for it. And so I wound up driving all the way through every country in Central America. I shipped my Jeep from Panama to Colombia. There's actually no road there across what's called the Darien Gap. It's about 100 miles of swamp and jungle. So I put it inside a shipping container. It shipped to Colombia. And then I flew. And then I picked the Jeep up in Colombia, and I drove all the way down to the bottom of Argentina. So kind of the whole length of South America, north to south. So over 2 years, I wound up driving through 17 countries, and it was 40,000 miles of the biggest, grandest adventure that I absolutely imagined possible. You know, I poked lava with a stick in Guatemala.
Yeah.
I climbed a 20,000 foot volcano in Ecuador. I went to so many like lakes and mountains and rivers, drove across the salt flats in Bolivia, spent months hiking in Patagonia. I basically just spent 2 years outside camping and enjoying myself. And when I got to a place I really loved, I would stay a few nights or a week. And if I got to a place I didn't really enjoy, I would just kind of move on straight away, find somewhere better. And I just did that endlessly for 2 years. And it changed my whole life around, Craig. It changed my whole priority system, my whole values, and it really sort of defined what I want to do with my life.
Yeah, and you do have two books, part one and two. You know, the road chose me, one and two. And I must admit, I did not get through one. I did not get through the first one. I have it, but I didn't get to the end. But I start reading it, and about maybe a quarter of the way through, and I can definitely recommend it to people because it is it's inspirational. And I guess one question I have is, do you think you'll ever have an Audible version of those two out?
It's funny you ask that, Craig. I am literally recording them right now. So,
oh, yes.
Yes, it's been on my to-do list for such a long time. Yes, there are audiobook versions coming in the very near future.
Oh, and so you're actually you're reading them.
Yes, yeah. Everyone has
Oh.
said they want to hear it in my accent, so I'm doing my best to record it without too many mistakes throughout the book.
Oh, that's perfect. I really like books that are read by the author best. You know, it's a lot of work to have to read it. I mean, by the time you're done writing it, you've probably had enough. You don't want to read it again, you know.
Well,
But
it's
yeah, go ahead.
incredible, actually, Craig. The Pan American Highway Adventure, that's nearly 20 years ago now. It's about 15 or 17 years ago. And so for me, reading the book actually is really exciting. And I
Oh,
really,
yeah.
yeah, it
Okay.
takes me back. And in my memory, I can remember exactly
Yes.
where I wild camped. And I can remember the street market I went to and, you know, the food that I ate. Like it all the memories come back. And it puts a huge smile on my face.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. Well, I'm sure that will people will be able to hear that in the words and feel it. That's so great because I love well, we all like Audible because I think we all have a stack of paper books that, you know, we're working on, but then, you know, when you have Audible, you can like you can just you, I can get through so many more books a year, you know.
Totally.
Yeah, it's like I listen to everything I can, and there's plenty left that I have to read on paper, which I don't mind. You know, paper is important. And so what that was like 2 years. So what were those 2 years? What years were those?
I started in the middle of 2009 and I finished in the middle of 2011.
Wow, okay, definitely. I would say a different time. You know, we're
Yeah,
always, yeah.
I was going to internet cafes. I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't even have a GPS. I mean, there was no Starlink. There was no iOverlander. I didn't bump into anyone else doing it until I was on the border of Belize and Guatemala. So I'd already been on the road 6 months or something before I met some people. They had just come up from South America. And so it was kind of a bit of a moment for me. I was like, wait, you can really do it? And they were like, absolutely, like you'll figure it out. All the borders are possible. You know, you'll figure out shipping the Jeep across from Panama to Colombia. Like, yes, it can be done. And that was kind of a solidifying moment of like, all right, I'm going to do this.
Wow. And so you really just went for it. You didn't really have a plan, right? I mean, there was some planning I remember from the book, but ultimately you just headed south.
Yeah, the idea, Craig, was I guess even when I left home, I hoped that I would make it to South America and maybe even the southern tip. But I didn't want to put all the pressure on myself or all the kind of expectations that I had to do it no matter what. So I wanted all along to say to myself, if I'm not enjoying this or if I don't feel safe, I don't have to keep going. I can just, you know, sell the Jeep or fly out or do something different with my life. This isn't some sort of like do or die, I have to keep going. So yeah, I had the idea that I would try and do the whole trip, but I honestly didn't even know if it was possible. Like if I had gotten to a particular border and they just said like, no, you cannot drive your vehicle in our country, I would have just been like, oh, okay, I didn't know that. I guess I'll come up with a different plan now. And I don't know what that would have been, but I was always open to the idea that like maybe this will turn into something else based on factors outside my control.
Oh, it's amazing. And
And I think
so,
actually,
good.
I think Craig, that actually made it easier. It felt like less daunting and less overwhelming. And I remember early on, even when I was in North America, people would start trying to tell me about Peru, or they would say, you know, when you're in Patagonia, make sure you go here. And I would just always say, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm like, I have no idea. That's like a year and a half from now. I can't possibly think about that. What am I going to do this week? I'm like, beyond this week or maybe this month, I'm like, I don't know. I'll just look at a map and sit down and talk to some people and like think about what's on the horizon. But all of that far distance stuff, it was kind of too stressful and too overwhelming to think about it too much. So I just didn't. I just was like, oh, I'll deal with it later.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. I'll just keep going south until until I reach the tip or not. Yeah.
Yeah, that's basically what it turned into, which made it like in a lot of ways, it just felt kind of relaxing and enjoyable. On any given day, I had no pressure. I had nothing I like mandatory had to do. Was more like, oh, if I want to, I could drive this direction and find some mountains, or this direction and find the beach, or stay where I am if I'm kind of tired, or you know, I want to rest for a couple of days.
Oh, it's amazing. That's amazing. And so that the Pan American Highway. Now, overlanding has definitely become a word. It's become a thing. There is overlanding, you know, shows, you know, I guess.
Yeah.
And then you've spoken at some of those, of course, you know. And so when your first trip, you know, on the Pan American Highway, that moment, those 2 years, and now, you know, what has changed in overlanding? It seems like it wasn't even a word at the time. It didn't really exist. And now it's definitely a noticeable part of the culture. I mean, there's magazines, there's, of course, there's all kinds of gear, there's, of course, you've been in some of those magazines, you know, but it seems like it went from zero to existing in a decade or something like that.
Yeah, especially in North America, Craig, it really took off. In South Africa and Australia, it kind of has been a thing for a lot longer than that. I'd say 40 or 50 years. It was really common to have a rooftop tent on a vehicle and you know, just kind of go out exploring for months at a time. But yeah, it's really taken off in North America, which I think is fantastic. It's really like helped to make it easier and more accessible, because there is so many more vehicles available that are really suitable for what we want to do. There's a lot more gear available in terms of fridges and rooftop tents or whatever, you know, whatever accessories a person wants. There's a lot more information out there about places to camp, about border crossings, about, you know, things to see and do. All of that kind of stuff now is more available and just kind of easier. So I think in the past, where like when I started out, it was kind of like a big unknown, and there was a lot of kind of misinformation or people that just didn't understand. Whereas now, I think it's just really common. Everyone's like, oh yeah, like, yes, you can drive the Pan American Highway. You know, here are the things, here's the paperwork you need, and you can sort of go about it in like a methodical manner. So on the whole, I think it's made it a lot easier and a lot more accessible, which I think is great.
Yeah, because I like that, because even though, yes, we definitely want, as I call them, escapements, you know, nature that you can't have any motorized vehicles on, I think that that's important. And we do need our vast expanses of forest and desert. But there's a book called Desert Solitaire. Oh, I forget the guy who wrote it, but it's an old book. It's from the 70s. But he was a park ranger, and he really got into, you know, access and accessibility versus, you know, the health of nature and et cetera, et cetera. And he really, the book will make you cry, basically, you know. But I do like when there's the accessibility. So is the Pan American Highway, from your knowledge, is it in better shape than it used to be? Because it seems like that whole highway might even be a bit of tourist money at this point.
Yeah, I think, Craig, even back when I did it, I think you probably could have been on pavement for more or less the entire trip if
gotcha.
You wanted to. So I think the highway itself is, you know, quite developed in every country, because it kind of just picks up whatever the main highway is north to south in each country.
Gotcha.
And so it really has always been about like how far off the highway do you want to get, and how much do you want to explore? It's sort of your choice, you know. Do you really want to go as far down every offshoot and every gravel road that you can find, or do you just want to stick to the straight and narrow and go straight down the path? It really is, in the truest sense, it's a choose your own adventure of how deep do you want to get in any region or any country. It's completely up to you.
Oh, I like that. Okay, so that's cool. I didn't know, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, for people listening, it kind of might be like if you headed down I-5, Interstate 5, from Seattle all the way down to like San Francisco or Los Angeles or something, you can literally just stay on the freeway and you could find a hotel, you know, less than 500 yards from the freeway. You could find gas stations and restaurants. And you could never be more than 500 yards off the freeway. And, you know, no problem. You can drive all the way to San Francisco. Or you could intentionally never even get on I-5 and be on all the secondary roads and find as many gravel roads and shoot off into the beaches, shoot up to the mountains, find the tiniest little out-of-the-way roadside cafes. And obviously, you know, the second type of trip is going to take much longer. You're going to travel a lot slower. But it's and on any given day, like if I woke up in the morning and it was pouring rain, maybe I'd be more inclined just to sort of sit on a good paved road and do a few hundred miles. But if it was a beautiful sunny day, I might look on a map and say, oh, where what kind of adventure can I find today? Oh, I hear there's a really good hike over here. I'll just drive 10 miles to the trailhead, you know, and then go hiking for the day. So it's exactly like that in every country on the Pan American. The option is yours every day.
Oh, that's great. Okay, wow. So definitely learning about it now a bit more. And because it's like here in Phoenix, you know, you can drive north to Sedona and you can do it on the 17, which is just a freeway, you know.
Yeah, I've done that drive exactly. Yeah,
you know, or you can hop off and you can drive basically from Phoenix to Sedona, all dirt roads. They're pretty much it's all public land, and it is kind of a, you know, choose your own adventure. The dirt road in general, or a couple of dirt roads, you make your little transitions. They're fine. You could drive a Volkswagen Bug if you wanted, you know, but, you can also, there's plenty of offshoots and, you know, and then like, here in Arizona, some of the drives you can do, you know, the it's really 4x4ing. I would say some of it you could call overlanding, but a lot of it really comes down to a bit of 4x4ing. But you can go out to old, you know, stagecoach ruins and such. And sometimes when you drive out there, you can't help but think, like, I've been driving for hours and I am so in the middle of nowhere that I can't imagine the people who used to work at this like stagecoach that would, you know, handle mail and change horses. And I thought, like, I drove here and I am beyond nowhere. it was like a 7-day ride to get to nowhere else.
It's, you know, wild, isn't it? And so the opportunities to explore are literally endless. You could spend the rest of your life exploring all of those back roads and all of those options and always find somewhere amazing.
Oh yeah. Especially when you find that, like here in America, it's amazing. You can take, so many ancient paths that are not really forgotten that you can take. So yeah, if you want pavement or dirt road or, you know, 4x4, you can get around the country. It's a lot of fun, parts of it at least. And so overlanding has changed. And so what's it like to, you know, speak at a overlanding convention now where they have all the new gear and the rock sliders and the tires and the suspensions and the $250,000 overlanding, you know, vehicles? You know, what's it like to be, I don't want to say a celebrity, but you just went out and did it because it was your passion. And now it's like, whoa, you mean other people are interested in this and they want to listen to me? Like, what's it like to be kind of an overlanding elder?
I'll take that as a compliment, Craig.
It is. It's a compliment. I'm an elder too. So, yeah.
it's actually really fun. My whole family are teachers going back forever. And so that's always sort of been a part of who I am. And the joke has always been that I'll become a teacher. And so for me, I'm really passionate about helping other people do it as well. And so, yeah, when I'm at Overland Expo, like, people come up to me and there's kind of all levels of people who have really done their homework and they have like hyper specific questions that they're really hung up on, or it really is kind of like, you know, they're a bit worried about it, or it's stopping them from going. And so I really love that I can just answer those questions just straight and like alleviate all of their concerns, you know, all the way down the range of people who kind of, they have this vague idea that they would like to hit the road and maybe see Alaska. But, you know, even just simple things, people say, oh, but isn't it really snowy and really cold? And I always have to say, well, not if you go in June, July and August, like the sun is up for 22 hours a day. Like you'll probably get sunburnt legitimately sunburnt in Alaska is very common. And so just all the way from like the basics all the way to kind of the more in-depth questions, I just genuinely enjoy being able to help and being able to answer that kind of, you know, those fears or those worries, I can help alleviate them. And it's great. I really enjoy it.
I can imagine that there's lots of fears and worries. And well, here's a quick one that I'll ask is, you know, there seems to me to be, you know, like your overlanding vehicle, which is something which I don't think is really new. I mean, like the Toyota Land Cruiser was an overlanding vehicle. It seems like in different parts of the world, overlanding vehicles were just tough 4x4s, you know, and that's very specific. They're not really as showy as a 4x4. So it seems like there's two different genres. And sometimes I think they get a little confused, where overlanding is a modest vehicle with some lift, probably, that can go long distances on challenging terrain, but not necessarily a hardcore 4x4 vehicle. Where 4x4ing, of course, that's rock sliders and super lift and you name it. And so do you think that the two cultures really understand each other? Because I see them being very different. And sometimes I think there's a little bit of confusion in who's who.
Yeah, I think, Craig, your description is spot on. And I think it's a very blurry line. There's a lot of crossover there. You know, there are overlanders who really enjoy the technical four-wheel driving. And so their vehicle is sort of more seriously built up. And then there are plenty of four-wheel drivers who enjoy camping out in nature and maybe going on a longer-term trip. And so I think in the middle of the two of them, there is a lot of crossover and a lot of sort of gear and experience and knowledge from one really converts over and helps with the other. And so there's tons we can learn from each other. There's tons we can share with each other. And so there's no reason for us to be like in any way in conflict or argument. It's more about, you know, hey, I'm really happy you guys enjoy doing that. Like, what can I learn from that? Or what can I incorporate into my setup or my kind of travel style to help make it more enjoyable?
Yeah, I think that when I look at the overland vehicles, I think that's good for the 4x4 community because when you're strictly just doing 4x4ing, when you're taking your vehicle to where you're going to be, you know, off-roading on a trailer, you know, and then you roll it off, or you drive it, you know, there, like 4x4ing is just such an extreme art, you might say, or an extreme interest. And one of the things I think that I've seen overlanding maybe have a positive effect on 4x4ing is to think a little bit about what you're actually building and what you need, because like, for instance, and this kind of relates to some of the videos that you've done on YouTube, tires and wheels and lifting, you know, there's a lot to think about. You know, when you lift a vehicle, it's going to be tippier. You know, it's always a certain stability you hit, changing the gear ratios, bigger tires, heavier wheels, brake the vehicle more, it's more stress. And then, of course, you get into brakes. And then you get into like, well, if your brakes aren't going to be adequate, now you're getting into really changing that vehicle's dynamics. And are you really sure you want to, you know, change it that much? Because are you certain of the stability? You know what I mean? And I think that overlanding maybe has helped 4x4s maybe get a little bit more targeted, like rather than just lift it, you know, maybe think about the geometry a little bit more. I think they're complementary.
Definitely, Craig. Yeah. And it is such a unique thing to North America that people would trailer their vehicle, you know, to a 4x4 trailhead. That doesn't happen in Australia. That doesn't happen in South Africa. People, there just kind of isn't that like a terrain for a start. Like Moab, it doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. It is so unique. And also people don't necessarily have the money to kind of have like a tow vehicle and like a play vehicle. So yeah. Overlanding sort of always did grow up as like a vehicle that needs to be good at everything. It needs to drive well on the road, but it also needs to be able to go off-road to remote places. And I do think you're absolutely spot on that overlanding is often about compromises and about trying to find the middle ground where, the vehicle is capable of going down the bumpy road or a bit of technical rock climbing, but it isn't purpose-built for that reason. That isn't the only thing that it does well. It also needs to be able to drive well on the highway at 60 miles an hour. It needs to be safe. It needs to be efficient. And it needs to be able to do it for tens of thousands of miles without, you know, breaking down or wearing out pieces.
Yeah. And I can see that actually, might be... Go ahead.
Sorry. To cut you
go
off.
Ahead, yeah.
An example I had at one of the shows, someone once asked me, they said, hey, we really want to drive to Alaska and our Jeep's all ready to go. but it drives horribly on the highway. And so we don't know what to do about it. And the more we talked about it, his local tire shop had recommended that he get 37 inch tires. Cause he said, everyone around here has 37s. If you don't have 37 inch tires, you know, you won't be able to take your Jeep to any fun places. And so this person had just gone ahead with that advice from the local tire shop. But of course, the more we got into it, the difference is, I said, you're trying to do something that no one around you is trying to do. You're trying to drive all the way to Alaska and back, you know, let's call it 20,000 miles. And so your needs are just different than everybody else's. So it kind of stands to reason that you shouldn't actually do what everyone else has done. And so this person, they went back to the stock size 33-inch tires. They put the stock suspension back on and they did their Alaska trip and they reached out to me and they said, like, that was the best advice we ever got, because there was a lot of highway driving and it was very enjoyable. And then when we were on gravel roads, and like, the Jeep did great. So actually having a stock vehicle for that particular trip was way better than having, you know, a rock crawling monster.
Oh yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause I have 33s right now I have a 78 Cherokee and it was the wide track. So they fit in the wheel wells very well. It does have a 4-inch lift, but it's proper. And, we're going to do a road trip on it. And I'm actually thinking about getting a set of the stock tires for it, just because if we're going to road trip across the country, I love the big tires. They're great. In general, it rides so nice. It's just beautiful. It looks cool. Everything about it is cool. But when I start thinking about driving to the East Coast from Arizona, I'm like, maybe just some, like, you know, just the stock tires that came on it would be really nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you were saying, you really have to think about, what are you trying to achieve? What is your purpose? And then make sure that you kind of head in that direction with all of your upgrades or modifications, or even the gear you bring with you. You know, if you're going somewhere that's extremely cold and snowing, probably a rooftop tent isn't much use.
Oh, yeah.
No,
that would
no. Whereas, again, they were invented in South Africa, and so of course they don't have to worry about snow, so it just isn't a concern there.
Yeah, and that's funny. Rooftop tents have become so well here in Arizona that there's lots of 4x4ing, sort of like overlanding at the state level, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a couple of years ago, they were something you rarely would see, if ever. And now they're, you know, very common. So it's funny where something that became common, you know, somewhere else is now common here, because I've never really thought about it. But I thought, once I began to see that, I was like, yeah, putting your tent on the roof, that works. That's a good idea, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And so, and then of course you throw in van life, which really is, it's not overlanding, nor is it 4x4. Van life is something, you know, there's magazines about it now, but that's just pretty much, you know, I'm not even sure how you define van life, but you know, how would you describe that? Cause that's kind of a trend we have today. And pretty much it just seems to me like people who are living in, you know, Volkswagen buses or Sprinters, or, you know, converted, you know, Dodge Caravans, or maybe something more expensive. But in general, it's like, maybe having a home base and a regular house, but you're mobile around the country, or maybe you're just, you know, it's definitely a trend that I don't think existed a decade or two ago, but now van life is really common.
Yeah. And I think, again, it has a lot of crossover with overlanding, and there's like a big blurry kind of middle ground where, like, there's plenty of overlanders who are doing van life and vice versa.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it kind of, again, it just depends what you want to do with your life and what kind of travel or what kind of adventure you want to have. And like you said, maybe van life is a kind of more about, I live full time in this vehicle, and it is my home. And I think they have a lot more creature comforts typically, because it is full time. Whereas overland is kind of a more like, you know, hey, we're going somewhere from A to B, whatever that is. But again, I mean, there's a lot of crossover, and there's a lot that we can learn from each other. And of course, a lot of gear has improved and gotten better because both exist. You know,
yeah.
just things like portable showers, you know, they've really become common and affordable now. Whereas 5 years ago, it was like, just use a cold bucket of water.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So there. Yeah. Yeah, and I remember there was one video you meant, it was called Top 5 Reasons Why I Overland Differently, and we've kind of already gone over that question about the going is the most important gear, and I like that, and I think that's a great point that you make in, you know, in that video and some of the others, that it really is the sense of adventure, you know, ultimately is the heart of overlanding. Like, would you say the heart of overlanding really isn't about the gear anyway? It's about the adventure.
100%. Yeah. I've always felt really strongly about that. It is about the actual trip and about the travel and the experiences that you have while you're on the trip.
Yeah, definitely. And then when it comes to overlanding, a person might not know exactly what they want to do yet, but they have this idea. And so, do you think a good way to figure out what your niche is, like what exactly you want to do, would be small adventures? I mean, I know this sounds almost, you know, comically simplistic, but you know, some people are not sure if they want to overland or do I just want a road trip, or, and it seems like just the going will show you, because it's the ultimate gear check. You'll figure it out. Go somewhere, do something that interests you, and it'll take you a step further.
That is exactly the advice that I give, Craig. And it is exactly how I got into it. When I first came to North America, I'd never heard of overlanding, but I kind of wanted to see a lot of the US and Canada. So I bought an old Jeep Cherokee. I threw a tent in the back, some camping gear, and then I just started driving around. And as I went along, you know, I learned that, I'd like to have a more comfortable chair. So I got a better camping chair, and then, you know, at one point I had some fishing rods with me, but I found it was too difficult to deal with all the different regulations and what are you going to use for bait in, because you don't know anything about a place you've never been to. So at some point along the way, I gave those away. And so kind of over the years, and then when I bought the little Jeep that I was going to drive to Argentina, before I even had an idea of driving to Argentina, I would just go camping on the weekends and just drive out and try to find a remote hot spring or go to check out some mountaintop. And it just helped me figure out what gear do I need? How do I like to travel? What distance a day is appropriate? You know, am I happy wild camping, or do I rather pay for camping every night or every second night so I can have a shower? All of those kinds of things I just sort of learned through experience and what did I enjoy. And then, of course, there was the trip where it just poured rain the whole trip and, you know, through chaos in the whole setup because I wasn't ready for that. But it was just through simple, small learning trips that I sort of built the confidence and built the experience to say, like, yeah, I could do this for months at a time and be happy and enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. I like that.
And I like doing it that way, too, because it didn't really cost any money. Like, my advice is always to people, like, just go in the vehicle you have right now. You know, take a ground tent, a couple of $100s, take a stove, and just go out for the weekend and see what you think. And then if you really enjoyed it, go again and maybe go for a longer weekend. And then maybe when you get 2 weeks off work, like, go again. And over time, you'll kind of learn, are you going because you really want to go four-wheel driving and you do actually want to build a big four-wheel drive? Or are you going because you really want to camp out in some, you know, beautiful spot by a river or a lake? In which case, it doesn't, like, any vehicle will take you there. Just the one you've got means you can go tomorrow. You don't have to save up for the next 5 years.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. Yeah. Because that's one of the things I found was that, like, I like dirt roads, but I don't really like 4x4ing that much.
And I am exactly the same, Craig. People always ask me, what kind of wheeling do I like doing? And strange, like, it's such a weird thing to say out loud, but, like, I don't actually enjoy wheeling. It's not something that I seek out or, like, go looking for. I much prefer, drive down a bumpy gravel road and maybe there's a little bit of wheeling at the end of it because it just gets you that final bit to the mountaintop or to the lake, or, you know, a little bit further than kind of most people can get. I'm like, that's fantastic for me. Then I'm happy. I'm going to set up camp and just enjoy the afternoon reading a book.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. And that definitely works, especially for people who don't want to tear their vehicle up, you know, because that's where you get into those two different worlds where you've got the overlanding world and the 4x4 world, you know. And if I went out 4x4ing in a vehicle that was just for that, and you know, like if I had, let's say, I don't know, like a slightly lifted, like 1999 XJ, you know, that was kind of trashed, right? And I didn't care, you know, sure, I'll go 4x4 that, but that would have to be a very purpose-built vehicle just for that, because it won't be good for anything else.
Yeah. No, and you're probably going to stay closer to home, and you're probably going to go with friends so they can drag the vehicle home when it breaks. So it all sort of like makes more sense to be like, yeah, I can just go and attack the biggest mud puddle that ever existed, because it'll break, and that's kind of part of the fun. But yeah, that is a totally different thing than like, I'm going to set out to drive a few thousand miles and like live out of this vehicle for the weeks that it takes me.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was one video that you did where it was just called We Drove Along a Cliff in Iceland, F622. And I won't say it, Slavlunger or something like that, overlanding, presented by Yokohama Tire. And one of the things that that video made me think about was, you know, one thing that, well, it's two things. One is to be so remote. And like all the 4x4ing I usually do is with other people. So a few of us go out, and I could call it overlanding. You're just going down dirt roads. You're going somewhere, you know. But if something breaks, then I'm like, whatever. One of us will just tow the other one home. And it happens more than I like to admit. You know, somebody's towing somebody, you know. And that's fine. Who cares, right? It's part of the fun. But you and your wife and your baby, you've gone out remote, and it's just you. There's no one to tow you if something breaks. I mean, how is that feeling? Do you ever get nervous out there when you're really in the middle of nowhere and you're like, wow, like if this thing stops running, we're just going to, I guess we'll just live here and set up, make a log cabin until someone else comes along and saves us.
It's actually kind of funny, Craig. I think early on, it is very nerve-wracking and it kind of feels like, oh my God, you know, we'll be stranded. It'll be horrible. But then I think as you do more of it, or as the trip goes on, you start to realize, especially when you're driving through like BLM land in the US, like every 10 miles or so, you see a great place to camp. And so, you know, there's a fire ring and there's some rocks set up, or think, hey, we could camp there. Oh, it's a bit early in the day. Let's go a bit further. And so you start to have this realization of like, it doesn't actually matter where we stop today, anywhere we're going to be comfortable, because we have all of our food, we have drinking water, we have a great place to sleep, we have our chairs, we have books, you know, whatever it is for our own entertainment. So then you start to realize, you know, we could stop at this campsite or we could go to the next one. And if we break down in between, we'll just stop there for the night. It doesn't actually matter. Like, it doesn't make any difference where we sleep. So then I think that takes off some of the stress of like, even if I had broken down in Africa and been stuck somewhere for a week, I would have been just as comfortable as if I had just kept driving for that, because I still would have just camped out in the middle of nowhere every night of that week. So
I like
you
that.
Start to realize, yeah, when you're self-contained, you're like, I'm actually fine. Like, there's no great emergency right now. Obviously, as if it did turn into like a week stuck in one place, you know, you start to run out of food and water and it would start to be a problem. But certainly for the first night or two, it kind of makes no difference if I'm stuck somewhere or if I've chosen to get to somewhere. I'm going to be just as comfortable in camp either way.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, and that reminds me of hunting. You know, when I lived in the Pacific Northwest, in Seattle, actually, well, outside of Seattle, you know, vast, beautiful expanses of woods to go hunting in, and sometimes for animals, yes, but also like mushrooms, you know, chanterelle mushrooms and everything else. So, and anyone who knows the Pacific Northwest knows that as soon as you walk 10 feet into the, you know, forest, you're lost, right? You can't, I mean, it's completely disorienting, you know, and, having been a hunting guide there, we used to do experiments with people where we'd be between cuts, you know, because the only way you can really move in the forest is where there's been, you know, a trees removed, you know, and so, and that's kind of everywhere. So you can move across there, but through the actual forest is very hard. But so we would just have someone just take a compass. Not a compass. We'd just say, just go which way you think, you know, there's a road that way. So just go that way until you find your way out, you know, and they'd say, oh, I've got a great sense of direction. I know what I'm doing. But we give them a GPS. We track them. you know, and even go with them, say, you just lead the way. And you'd find that they'd be walking circles, changing direction. And eventually, you know, you use your compass and say, let's go this way. And they'd be amazed at how lost they would get. And so something I had to really make peace with in the Pacific Northwest was just being absolutely lost. And I had to just realize that I've got everything. I have a little tent. I'd rather not, you know, sleep on the ground in it, but I could. I have it. I've got this, I've got that, you know, and I kind of got to where I felt better when I knew if I just sat down and lay down, I could spend the night. So even if you get terribly lost, you're like, well, I'm fine. I can just lay down, put my little tent up, and I'll try to find my way out in the morning, you know, and if it doesn't work, I'll just try the next day. And eventually I can just use my compass and figure my way out. But I had to make peace with being lost. And that was really a challenging thing. But once you made peace with that, it was really an empowering thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it kind of takes the pressure off, doesn't it? It makes it feel a lot less kind of committing or serious, where you're just like, you know, I might be a day or two late, but I'll be fine. There's no reason to panic. There's no like kind of danger immediately.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And then one thing about the Iceland trip that you've done, I think that's your latest one. You guys were in Iceland for a bit and you got amazing footage of that and some great drone work while you're crossing, you know, rivers and such, or streams, climbing things. I think this is maybe something that for a lot of 4x4s, but also really especially overlanders, you know, and even people who like road trips, one of the things that many people find challenging, I know I do, is I hate hanging off the side of cliffs. Mm. It just, I'm never at peace with it. I don't enjoy it. It's just like, so I'm working on somehow clearing that out, somehow getting over that. I would rather just enjoy the experience. But when I'm looking down like 1,000 feet and I'm just like, oh, that looks really terrible. I hate that. You know, have you made peace with that, or does it just not bother you? And I know some people, it just doesn't even phase them.
It's been really interesting, Craig. It has never phased me at all. I've never been bothered by it, but my partner Katie is very, very uncomfortable. She hates it. So I've had to kind of like live through her and understand and try to coach her through it. And it's interesting because these days she does a lot of the driving actually, because I'm flying the drone or like running around with cameras trying to get footage. And so it's been really interesting to understand like why she's afraid. Mm-hmm. And like she kind of has this idea that the vehicle might just suddenly like go off the cliff. And I can't relate to that, because I'm like, I kind of understand how the machinery works. And I'm like, if ever I feel like things are going a little bit wrong, I'll go slower. And if I still don't feel good, I'll stop. And I'll put the vehicle in park, I'll pull the e-brake and I'll turn the engine off, and then I'll have a look and I'll think about what's happening and like why and what do I need to do differently. I kind of feel like there's no rush. There's no like suddenly we went off a cliff. Like that didn't happen suddenly. Like go as slow as the vehicle will go, and nothing's going to happen suddenly. Like it's going to take 30 seconds for it to even get within a foot of the edge. Just go slower. And so I feel like it's kind of, again, just like, break it down into like small manageable pieces. And even sometimes, you know, she's driving along, she feels really nervous. She's like, I think I'm really close to the edge. I'm like, that's okay. Like stop the vehicle, you know, turn the engine off. Let's jump out and have a look and like walk around and how close to the edge actually are we? She's like, oh, we've got like 6 feet to the edge. I'm like, so we're like, this is actually fine, isn't it? She's like, oh yeah, I guess it is. And then, so we continue. So it's just kind of like learn and evaluate and look. And again, it's just like slow down and think about it. It makes a big difference, I think.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Yeah.
But obviously, I guess that advice goes out the window if the trail really is like insanely narrow. Like I've never driven Black Bear Pass or any of those kind of like real notorious ones. Maybe my advice won't help when your tire really is half off the edge and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
Maybe then I would be freaking out. I don't know.
Yeah. We have some here in I say Colorado. I lived in Colorado too, but here in Arizona, where we have, you know, well-known precarious, you know, routes. And And I always wondered them. I just don't get what people like about them. I'm like, that just looks terrible. Why would you ever? And they go, oh, the views are beautiful. I'm like, no, they're not. They're terrifying.
Yeah. I did, Craig, when I was in Bolivia, I did actually drive the death road. So it's for many years, it was called the world's most deadly road. More people have been killed on it than any other road in history. And it's kind of a combination. It is just glued to the side of a mountain. But also it was extremely busy with buses and trucks.
Ooh.
And they would always try to pass each other where there just physically wasn't enough space. And so vehicles would commonly like just fall off the mountain.
Yeah, that's something. Well, I think when it comes to a fear of heights, that makes the cliff hanging very difficult, because you get, even though you don't want to, maybe rationally, you know, everything is fine, you get disoriented, you just get panic, and it's just very difficult. So I tell you, at an overlanding convention, somebody who was a really good hypnotist, you know, could make a lot of money and a lot of clients if they they could help program people not to be afraid, because most who are would rather not be. But when the fear takes over, you just start panicking. It's very difficult, you know.
Yeah, and I think then it gets really hard to judge distances and kind of like
you feel like
you're on the edge when you're really kind of 6 feet back from the edge.
Yes,
it's hard to judge.
Yeah. Yeah, 6 feet's not so bad, but yeah, when it's like 4 inches, starts getting scary.
That starts getting serious.
Yeah, it does. And so, one of your videos, Dan Grech, on circumnavigating Australia and the importance of connection with family, there was three things that you touched on that I thought were great. It's like to get your like little commentary on those was. Set your desktop to be somewhere you want to see. And that sounds like it's something that you've, you know, been doing for quite a while. And that philosophy I like. Tell us about that. Do you actually do that? You set your desktop on your laptop to be the next place you want to go?
100%, Craig. I can see it right now as I'm talking to you. And actually on the wall in front of me are photos and posters from places that we dream of going. Yeah, and for me, that's all about kind of like keeping myself motivated and keeping me focused on like, what are my goals and what am I working towards? You know, and a big part of it for us is we need to save money before we can go. We don't have unlimited money, sadly. And so, you know, by choosing not to go out for dinner tonight, you know, instead we're going to cook at home, we'll be saving that $50 or whatever it is. That's what the $50 is going to go towards. We're going to eventually get to that place that I'm looking at right now. And kind of every decision that we make during our days and weeks, and it's probably going to turn into years before we can get on the road again, you need to stay sort of motivated and keep your eyes on the prize so that you can motivate yourself to keep working towards that big goal, that big dream.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. And I think that's really important. You know, well, I guess kind of a new agey term for it is vision board, you know,
yeah.
But I don't think there's anything wrong with having that. I really don't. I think that's something that, especially as adults, we stop doing. You know, I think it's essential. And like when I heard that in your video, I thought, you know, I need to do that as well. Like, why don't I have all that stuff? You know, like, why don't I have my vision board pinned up? Because that will get you there faster.
Yeah. And these big trips, you know, like if you do want to go to Alaska for a summer, like it does take a lot of kind of preparation and time, and trying to get the time off work can be a big deal. Trying to save the money, you know, organizing to get kids off school, like all of those things, you can't just kind of go tomorrow. So there's a big time period there of, yeah, saving money and kind of dreaming. And so I personally find it's really helpful to just keep me motivated. And, you know, I really did when I was setting out or saving up for the Pan American Highway, I really did have photos of Alaska plastered all over my room and actually on my mirror in the bathroom. So literally I'd be brushing my teeth in the morning, looking at Alaska saying like, yes, I'm coming. Like I'm going to get there. I'm working on it.
Oh, that's so amazing. Yeah. What we can do while we're brushing our teeth, that definitely gets overlooked. And you've mentioned that you do what you're you look over your Jeep in the morning when you're overlanding. You look over your you're pulling your suspension parts and such while you're brushing your teeth.
Yeah, one of the things, a habit I tried to get into was kind of a daily walk around of the vehicle. And so I like to open the hood and just have a look. And I don't necessarily have like a great mechanic background. I'm not an expert, but you know, if there was a big oil leak or if the belt was frayed or if the battery terminals were loose, like I want to kind of pick up on those as early as possible. So I think it really helps to just have a look at everything. Are the tires round? You know, like does anything look like it's loose in the suspension? Is it making any strange noises? Just kind of that constant checking to make sure that everything is as it should be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you mentioned that you don't want, you said, I don't want my life to be easy. You said, I don't want my life to be easy. Yeah. I don't want my life to be easy. I want it to be rewarding, you know, and that's amazing. And Robert Young Pelton, who's been on the show, he mentioned that like our fear of failure is keeping us from being great, you know, and such. And so really, I think a lot of our, you know, brothers and sisters out there are very burnt out, and they really don't have that vision, that vision board, and they just want life to, like, it's hard enough, and it can be very challenging to get into that bit of struggle that makes it rewarding. You know, and it seems like one of the things that you're doing with Overlanding and in your channel is that you're kind of giving people that inspiration to, hey, you know what? I know you go to work, like you probably don't like your job very much, but if you had a vision of something you wanted to do and you started like, you know, camping on weekends and you started to figure out what kind of vehicle do I need? Do I want to be on highways? Do I want to be on, you know, dirt roads? Like you could sort of invigorate a bit of like passion, but you have to get out there. The most important thing is that you do something like this weekend towards that end.
Yeah, absolutely, Craig. And I can actually remember the exact day, the exact moment. I was out with a friend. We did kind of a weekend backpacking trip in the Yukon, like way out in the middle of nowhere. And it was a beautiful sunny day, and we'd been taking photos of a glacier, and there was a grizzly bear. And I turned to my friend and I said, "This is what I want my life to be. I want to find a way to do this as much as I can in my life and do less of the sitting at a desk," which I was going back to on Monday morning. And so ever since then, I've been, you know, taking photos and writing for magazines and you know, speaking events and everything that I can possibly do to get me out there like that as much as I possibly can.
Yeah, and you mentioned in that same video, circumventing Australia, you said the roar of the lion is in your DNA. And I like that. And I think that, you know, something that's very unfortunate in our in the last few decades, hobbies have gone downhill. People aren't really, you know, 6 to 10 year old kids aren't really getting into hobbies. They're not really getting into the manual dexterity. And that's something that I hope to help, you know, reinvigorate, but also adults aren't, you know, having hobbies either, and or interests. And so I like what you're doing, because I think it helps people realize that it is possible. And you know, overlanding could be also just road trips. I mean, it's one of the things here in America. I mean, it's so big, and there's so many different places. You could spend a lot of time just road tripping. I mean, and so overlanding can be strictly on really, you know, pavement as well, right? Just, I want to drive across, I want to see the mountain roads in Colorado, for instance,
Absolutely, Craig.
could be an
100%.
overlanding journey. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't think it helps to try and like really define it and
Yeah.
say who is and who isn't overlanding. I really wanted like anyone that wants to get out there and have adventure, and maybe actually they really love rock climbing and that's their passion, and they really just kind of drive out to some remote spot and then set up a base camp for a week and rock climb for the whole week. Like that's phenomenal. Those people probably want to have a fridge. They probably want to have a nice place to sleep. So are they overlanders? Like, I think the answer is yes. And I think it's like the more people out there doing what they love, the better.
Yeah, I like that. And I think that yeah, because the roar of the lion really is in our DNA. And let's see, is there anything else? I've had you for a little over an hour. I don't want to keep you too long. You know, one question I'll ask, just for this is one that I think is fun and I think you might have some insight on. And it's for overlanding. What is the, here's the thing. Right now we're seeing, like I love classic full-size Jeeps. You know, I've got my 78 Cherokee that I've been restoring and, you know, like, and one of the things that I see so much of right now is the, I'll be a little bit judgmental, okay? The pointless modernization of vehicles. Like the LS engines, as I say, LS just being, this is the first two of the serial is, no, the first two of the model number is LS, meaning it's a newer engine. So I see lots of LS conversions. And that is neat, but we don't always see all the LS failures and the expense. So I see a lot of modernized classic vehicles. And that's cool. And one should do it if they want. But I kind of think if you're overlanding and you're in any vehicle, be it new or be it classic, the best engine is the one that came in it. How does that sound to someone who's got a massive amount of experience like you?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, Craig. But I think there's a tricky overlap there. Like we were saying, four-wheel driving, overlanding, van life,
yeah,
with a bunch of sort of blurry in the middle. I think the same thing goes for like owning an older vehicle, four-wheel drive or classic or even a sports car, or actually just having a vehicle that you want to take on trips. I think a lot of people that own older vehicles, the vehicle itself is the hobby. It is the enjoyment. Working on it, upgrading it, you know, polishing it, that's where people are deriving their enjoyment, which is fantastic. Like, more power to them. Then I think there are people who the vehicle is purely utilitarian and they're just going to take it on a trip and, you know, they have no love for it. They don't name it. They're happy to sell it at the end. But then, of course, there's a huge blurry ground in the middle.
Yeah.
People who, you know, and I think it just depends on, are you getting your enjoyment out of, you know what, I'm going to try and get some more horsepower. I'm going to try and make it more efficient, smoother, quieter, and more fun to drive. And that actually is what I enjoy. And yeah, I might go out on the weekends and do some trips in it. But the, doing the trips isn't necessarily the goal or isn't
kind of
the purpose. So again, I think it just comes down to like, what does a person want to use it for? Are they really happy tinkering away in their garage? Or do they just want a vehicle they can just go? And, you know, if you buy a modern vehicle with any badge on the front, you can just drive across up to Alaska next week and not expect to have a single breakdown or have any mechanical problems of any kind. So again, it just depends what an individual wants to do and what makes them happy. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
Said, sorry, Craig, for the kinds of trips that I do though, and you know, if someone was looking to go to Alaska, never ever on all of my trips have I ever wanted more horsepower. All I've ever wanted is reliability and more fuel economy. So like, you know, use less fuel because it's so expensive. So for me, lots of people ask me, when am I going to LS swap my Jeep?
Yeah.
And the answer is never. It makes no sense for me, for what I do. It absolutely is. Or when am I going to supercharge it? Like, never. It's not something I would ever consider because it's not something that I enjoy doing or that makes sense for my trips.
Oh no, it makes so much sense. Yeah. Yeah. Cause like, it's funny how we change as we get, you know, wiser or maybe a little older or more experienced, you know.
Well, there's that too. Like there's no one size fits all.
Yeah.
And there's even as we change, our preferences and what we wanted when we were 20 is different in our 30s, 40s, 50s. So again, it's not about trying to find the perfect or the ultimate or the best. It's just do what works for you now and that you enjoy. Do the thing, do the trip, do the engine upgrade, whatever it is you want to do. Because in 5 years, you might not want to do that anymore. And you look back and say, I'm really glad I did that, but I wouldn't do it again. I'm ready to do something different now because my needs have changed or because I'm older or because I just don't want to do that anymore.
Oh, I totally get it. Yeah. It's like I had an old Dodge pickup truck that I guess you could say we did some overlanding in. We slid a little pop-up camper in it and would cruise around the mountains of Colorado. And it had a slant six in it. It had a Dodge, you know, a slant six. And you know, people thought, don't you want to put a 318 or a 360 or something in there? And I was like, no, I don't. I don't. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's gutless and beautiful. I love it.
Yeah. And it's such a crazy thing too. I'm not sure that people really sort of put the dots together, but you know, for the amount of money you would spend on that kind of engine swap, you could take a month off work and drive to Alaska. Like,
yes.
And for the rest of your life, and trust me on this, you'll never forget, you know, Alaska. It's amazing. I personally value that so much higher than having more horsepower. Just, it's a really easy decision for me to make.
I like that. And that might be like, you know, a great way to tie things up, that like the best gear you'll ever buy is just going, you know?
And what's incredible, I know, like, we stress over like what tent to buy, or, you know, what kind of stove is the best? Should I get induction? Should I get gas? Like, all of those decisions, they feel so important and they feel so kind of difficult. 10 years later, or now it's been 15 years since I was on the Pan American, like, none of those decisions mattered at all. Who cares? Like, just take whatever you've already got, or take whatever's easier, or like, the going is, and the adventures that I had and the people I met and the things I saw are going to stick with me for the rest of my life. You know, the brand that was on my tent or that was on my vehicle, it just didn't matter. It's just not that important.
I like that. Yeah. So yeah, kind of in all things, you know, like, listen for that roar of the lion in your DNA and let that roar out and just go, just do it, you know, just do it.
Yeah. Go is always my message.
Just go.
You know, people say, oh, I have $1,000 to spend on my Jeep. What upgrade should I get? Every time my answer is throw your tent in the back, put gas in the tank and go away for the weekend. That's what you should do with your Jeep. Like that's what it was made for. And that's the reason to own, you know, a vehicle like that.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, yeah. And even if you have a Toyota, you can do the same thing with like a Tacoma or something. You can you can do it.
Yeah. I mean, even if you have a Subaru or a RAV4, like, go. Get out there. Spend the money on gas in the tank and spend time with it, you know, with your partner or with your kids or your friends. Like, get out there. Sit around a campfire and tell some funny stories. I think you're going to enjoy spending the money that way a lot more than anything that you can buy in a store.
Oh yeah, I love that. Get your Subaru Outback out there. Yeah. Yeah, I love it. Wow. Well, Dan Grech, it has been so amazing talking to you. And you know, if people want to know more, it's theroadshowsme.com. And maybe one, you know, question I'd ask as we, you know, wrap things up. Of course, you know, along with where can people get a hold of you? Maybe that's a good start. Your website, but also, how did that humble name come to be? The Road Shows Me.
It's a good story, Craig.
Okay.
I was living in Canada at the time. I'm from Australia a long time ago. And my brother had come out to visit. And so he and I had been kind of having some adventures in the mountains together and hiking and finding hot springs. And I told him, he was one of the first people I told this plan that I was going to try and drive to Argentina or go and live on the road for a while. And so we were excited and bouncing ideas off each other. And I wanted to start a blog at the time. Blogging was what you did. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of spent a whole weekend out camping and hiking. And we came up with a short list of about 20 names that could have been it. And we just kind of rolled them around for the weekend and just played around and talked about it. And what did it mean to me? And so the Road Shows Me just kept surfacing as like, I had sort of done the career track. I'd done the snowboarding thing. I'd kind of explored a bunch of different things I wanted to do with my life. And then I was like, maybe I want to be on the road for a while. Like, I think the road has chosen this path ahead of me. Let's kind of explore that. And it really stuck. And I, to this day, I'm still really happy that that's the one we chose.
Oh, I love that. You know, and maybe that's the key. When you just go, the road will choose you.
Maybe I'll add that as my catchphrase.
Yeah, I love it. It's all yours. Well, Dan Grech, thank you so much for being on. I'm going to stop recording now.
Thanks, Greg. That was a real pleasure. Great talking to you.
All right.